fighting over paper towels and toilet paper. Suppose we're fighting over the last sack of potatoes in the store. That could happen if this labor force were not here, yet we criminalize it. We put obstacles for access to care, and then we wonder if we're going to have a food shortage.
Language barriers, Dr. David Hayes Bautista, when it comes to getting information about COVID-19?
Medical services have been provided. In fact, we had the first smallpox vaccination campaign in 1803 in California in Spanish. We were part of Spain at the time. Medical services have been provided in California in Spanish for 251 years. We came into the United States as a bilingual state. Spanish was one of the official languages. And yet, Latinos are least likely to find a physician who speaks Spanish. The shortage is tremendous. But it's not because this is a new issue. This is California. What we have done for 160 years is chosen to turn our back on this population, not allow it access to the investments we're making in other populations, either for education or health care. They'll wonder why there's an issue.
Dr. David Hayes Bautista, I want to thank you so much for being with us, distinguished professor of medicine and director of the Center for the Study of Latino Health and Culture at the UCLA Medical School. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the virtual show for good featuring the Cupcake Girls on Friday, July 24th from 5 to 6 p.m., live streaming on Zoom. The Virtual Show for Good is a virtual variety show meets fundraiser in support of local nonprofits severely impacted by COVID-19. The Cupcake Girls is an organization that provides resources and holistic services to sex workers and those affected by domestic human trafficking. Again, that's the Virtual Show for Good featuring the Cupcake Girls on Friday, July 24th from 5 to 6 p.m., live streaming on Zoom. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Police brutality against demonstrators in Portland continued for the 54th consecutive night. Coronavirus numbers continue to rise in the state, prompting further restrictions. And in national news, the Trump administration intends to send federal agents to other cities across the country. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The amount of COVID-19 cases continues to rise in Oregon, as Governor Kate Brown again expands the state's mask policy. The new policy now applies to children as young as 5 and requires all individuals to wear masks in indoor spaces as well as outdoor spaces where physical social distancing is not possible. Brown is also considering requiring a mandatory self-quarantine of people entering the state from areas that are known to be COVID-19 hotspots. Oregon reported 7 new deaths from the virus on Tuesday, tying the number of most deaths in the state in one day. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 264 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 in the state. This brings the total number of reported cases in the state up to 15,393. The total death toll in Oregon is 271 people. The state has reported at least 200 new cases every day for the past 2 weeks. Oregon is also easing restrictions on visits to long-term care centers such as nursing homes, so long as those visits occur outside and do not include households that have COVID-19 infections. Indoor visitation remains off-limits at all licensed care facilities. Facilities with current COVID-19 infections cannot allow visitation. The Oregon Health Authority warns of testing supply shortages and that testing wait times in Oregon could be affected by growing national demand for testing supplies as COVID-19 cases increase across the country. Some Oregonians have reported having to wait up to 2 weeks to find out their coronavirus test results. By then, they might have already infected others and could have forgotten some of the people or locations they had visited weeks earlier. This renders contact tracing, the system of tracking down all known contacts of the infected person, much less effective. The Portland City Council will vote on COVID-19 priorities today. Currently, the ordinance would allocate about $20 million each for public health services, houseless services, and assisting low-income households with meals, groceries, and gift cards. Another $17 million would go toward rent and housing assistance, while $15 million would support small businesses hurt by the pandemic-related shutdown. The funding is part of the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act, that was previously approved by Congress. Nationally, the number of coronavirus cases continues to grow quickly. As of Tuesday afternoon, nearly 4 million people have tested positive for the virus in the U.S. At least 142,000 patients with the virus have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 15 million people in nearly every country. Over 600,000 people have died. Nearly 2,000 people in Portland came together on Tuesday night to again protest police brutality. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Nat Moon.
An estimated 2,000 people gathered on Tuesday in downtown Portland for the 54th consecutive night to protest police brutality, and police again brutalized them using tear gas and other forms of physical violence deemed illegal by the Geneva Convention. People dressed in black, holding umbrellas and other makeshift shields, formed a line to protect those more vulnerable to the attack. Two groups of protesters, Wall of Moms and PDX Dad Pod, also formed a protective barrier between those demonstrating and the police, and were subsequently attacked by batons and tear gas. According to multiple journalist accounts, many officers were carrying assault rifles against a crowd armed with hope and leaf blowers. Mutual aid tent Riot Ribs was specifically targeted as federal agents pepper sprayed the interior of their grills and bags holding food, slashed open water bottle cases, and broke their tent. Medics were also targeted with supplies like tampons, gloves, and hand sanitizers, now rendered useless due to the purposeful contamination with pepper spray. The federal courthouse is reportedly putting up concrete barriers in preparation for the protest to continue tonight. According to his office, Mayor Ted Wheeler is expected to appear in front of the Justice Center at 9 p.m. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
A motion seeking a restraining order has been filed by 10 journalists and observers with the American Civil Liberties Union in Oregon. The restraining order is intended to hold federal officers to the same restrictions that a judge recently placed on Portland police, which stipulates that journalists with professional or authorized press passes and legal observers are exempt from orders requiring protesters to leave after police declare an unlawful assembly or riot. The judge also directed that Portland police shall not arrest, threaten to arrest, or use force against journalists or legal observers. They are not supposed to be able to seize cameras or audio equipment unless they believe a crime has been committed. Andrew Warden, a U.S. Department of Justice senior trial counsel, said such restrictions would be unworkable for federal officers. Documentation and sworn statements prove that journalists and legal observers have been hit by rounds, tear gas, and other munitions. Warden also said that any injuries to journalists or others resulted from the, quote, unintended consequences of an otherwise constitutional use of force under the circumstances. Federal lawyers argue it would be too difficult to see press passes or the brightly colored vest and hat of legal observers in the dark. The Trump administration has renewed its commitment to sending federal agents into multiple major cities across the country after what many have called their experiment in Portland. President Donald Trump and Attorney General William Barr are expected to announce today that federal troops will be sent into Chicago and other Democratic cities in an attempt to restore, quote, law and order. Hundreds of agents have already been sent to Kansas City after the shooting of Legend Taliaferro, a 4-year-old boy who was killed while sleeping late last month. U.S. Attorney Timothy Garrison told NPR that, quote, these federal agents will be clearly identified by their agency's visible badge or insignia. That is in stark contrast to federal agents in Portland who have been documented covering up their badges and names with tape and refusing to give their badge numbers when asked. Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf said yesterday on Fox News, quote, because we don't have that local support, that local law enforcement support, we are having to go out and proactively arrest individuals. Proactively means arresting people who have not committed a crime, a definition that also applies to kidnapping. He also said that the federal officers are not bound by the physical restriction of federal property, the protection of which is used as their justification for being in Portland. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is glued to his TV.
The hottest reality show these days is Democracy in Danger, Portland. The invaders have flashbangs, chemical agents, rented vans. We have a wall of moms, thousands of people ready to march or lay down on a bridge, folks with leaf blowers and hockey sticks for tear gas, and a 53-year-old veteran, the camo shirts, batons couldn't budge. Meanwhile, Trump combines distraction and obstruction, sins of commission and omission. He hopes infection will help his re-election. By stifling the facts, states don't know how to act. As things get worse, he tightens the federal purse. By increasing the 1%'s profits, he deprives many of us of what we need to just get by. The first and only season climax will be in November. Trump thinks what we don't know, like COVID numbers, who's doing what with federal funds, can't hurt him. But we know more than enough to evict and multiply convict him as Mar-a-Lago becomes the world's most expensive asylum. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The Oklahoma Supreme Court has ruled against two tribes in the state, saying that the gaming agreements signed in April are now invalid. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Oto, Missouri, and Comanche nations disagree with the Oklahoma Supreme Court, which ruled their recent compacts with the state are invalid under Oklahoma law. In statements Tuesday, the tribe said the compacts are legal under federal law and maintain their tribal sovereignty. The tribe signed compacts with Governor Kevin Stitt in April, which included sports betting and house-banked cards illegal in Oklahoma. The compacts were approved on the federal level in June. Comanche Nation Chairman William Nelson Sr. in a statement said the tribe will continue to operate gaming under the terms of the compact outside of offering games not authorized by the state. Oto, Missouri Chairman John Shotton also said in a statement the tribe will continue to operate under terms of the compact and refrain from those games. Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter applauded the court ruling. In a statement, Hunter said the governor lacks authority to enter into and bind the state to compacts with tribes that authorize gaming activity prohibited by the state. The Tulsa World reports a similar gaming compact case is pending in the state's high court and a federal lawsuit involving some other tribes. Tribes are suing the governor over their gaming compacts, which they say automatically renewed at the beginning of the year, but the governor disagrees and is seeking higher fees. The compacts have soured relationships between gaming tribes in the state. While tribes negotiating compacts maintain their sovereignty, other tribes want a united stance. The issue led to the Oto, Missouri, and Comanche Nation membership suspended in May from the Oklahoma Indian Gaming Association. The U.S. Census and tribal partners are working to keep momentum going among American Indian and Alaska Native people to complete the 2020 Census questionnaire. Chairman of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians in North Dakota, Jamie Azure, says the tribe was undercounted 10 years ago, and is encouraging Native people to be counted in the 2020 census, which he says will help the tribe move forward, including in areas of economic development and providing services for tribal citizens.
Getting that information out to our membership of not only being counted, but the importance of being counted. A lot of it stems back to even historical trauma with distrust with the state governments and distrust with the federal governments. That's why we really, really focus on the data. You know, that's how we move forward. Education, data, how we rise as a nation.
The tribe hosted a recent drive-up census event where vehicles pulled through and were given information and prizes. COVID-19 has hindered in-person census activity in recent months. Door-to-door workers will be going to households which have not responded to the census. The workers will be following federal COVID-19 public health guidelines, which include social distancing and wearing masks. A handful of tribes in the Denver region will not have workers visiting homes due to COVID-19 community lockdowns. Door-to-door census takers are expected to visit households through October 31st, when the census collection ends. Dr. Jill Biden joined the Democratic National Committee Native Caucus Tuesday to discuss Native American issues and how her husband, Joe Biden, would address them if elected president of the United States. During a call with the caucus, Jill Biden campaigned for her husband, saying he believes in tribal sovereignty and stands with Indian country.
We will work hard to earn your trust, and we will always stand with Indian country. And I hope that you will believe in us as well.
Joe Biden's campaign promises to Indian country include improving healthcare, education, addressing violence against women, and examining climate change. Also on the call were Senator Tina Smith, Representative Sharice Davids, and members of the Native community who talked about the importance of the Native vote and putting tribal issues before the federal government and Congress. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview about the dangers of tear gas exposure with Damon Mott Story from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, followed by News from the Boo. Then at 6, it's The Underground, hosted by KBOO's very cool youth collective. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio, the daily hip-hop talk show. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 58 degrees. Tomorrow will also be partly cloudy with a high of 77 degrees. Today in history, in 1853, Errico Malatesta was born. Malatesta was an anarchist involved in strikes and insurrections in Italy and faced exile and imprisonment under the fascist rule of Mussolini. The quote of the day is from Malatesta, who said, quote, "We anarchists don't want to emancipate the people. We want the people to emancipate themselves." In a decision that will likely affect the 2020 presidential election, President Trump has ordered the exclusion of undocumented immigrants in the census count for drawing districts. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
It's been reported by the president's staff that the president is, quote, not really working this anymore. He doesn't want to be distracted by it.
Former Vice President Joe Biden criticized President Trump's lack of attention to the public health and economic crisis. And the same day, in the face of surging COVID-19 cases and declining poll numbers, Trump restarted his daily coronavirus task force briefings, noticeably without Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. agency in charge of handling infectious diseases. Despite Trump's continued opposition to vote by mail, court decisions in three states expanded it this week. Alabama now has no excuse absentee voting for the November election, Vermont will send ballots to all registered voters, and Connecticut Supreme Court Chief Justice Richard Robinson dismissed a lawsuit attempting to prevent the state from allowing voters, fearful of contracting COVID-19, to use absentee ballots in the state's August primary. Connecticut Secretary of State Denise Merrill supports a bill to extend this ability to November and beyond.
The state constitution talks about, you know, unable to get to the polls due to illness. No one has ever really defined what that means or tested that situation. Are we in that situation? I believe we are.
The Connecticut suit was brought by four Republican candidates for Congress who are part of an organization called Fight Voter Fraud, a 501c4 so-called dark money group, meaning they don't have to disclose their donors. Biden says he'll announce his VP pick in early August. Four African-American women are reported on the current list. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms' name has been floated.
There is going to be an effort to suppress our vote, especially in Black and brown communities. We've got to vote early and do it in such high numbers that even when some votes are suppressed, because it's going to happen, that there's still no room for error.
Yesterday, Bottoms joined Everytown for Gun Safety's virtual series called Demanding Women. Each installment appears to feature another potential VP pick. Senator Tammy Duckworth will be on this Thursday. Duckworth and her fellow Illinois Senator Richard Durbin have written to President Trump proactively urging him not to deploy federal law enforcement to Chicago. They join a growing list of lawmakers condemning the unrequested use of federal agents, some without identification, to quell protests in Portland, Oregon. And the White House issued an executive order to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census count used to draw congressional districts. UCLA law professor Laura Gomez, who recently authored the book Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism, expects legal challenges, but they'll likely take some time.
I think at the end of the day, it's certainly not going to be decided in the courts before the election. And I think that that's what this is all about, right? This is all about him reaching out to his base to say, look, I'm still on this. I'm still fighting against those 11 million people who are immigrants in this country but don't have legal authorization to be here.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
In the first COVID-19 briefing in months, President Donald Trump admitted that the pandemic will continue getting worse and advised people to wear masks, two things he's never said before. At the briefing, he said, quote, "Get a mask. Whether you like the mask or not, they have an impact." He did, however, stick to his previous line that the virus would soon disappear and that the United States was responding to the pandemic better than other parts of the world. Meanwhile, the United States has the most confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the world, as well as the most deaths from the virus. Both statistics are likely underreported, particularly due to the recent attempt by the Trump administration to reroute coronavirus data from the CDC to a different and private federal database. Trump also again referred to COVID-19 using a racist term. Whereas past briefings lasted up to 2 hours and covered a variety of topics, yesterday's briefing focused on the virus with a duration of only half an hour. Trump was also asked about Ghislaine Maxwell, who faces charges of recruiting, grooming, and sexually abusing girls with Jeffrey Epstein. Trump said he, quote, wishes her well. Also, unlike past briefings, no medical or scientific professionals were on stage with the president. The briefings are expected to continue several times a week. And now it's time for Labor History in 2. Today in labor history, the United States was in the middle of a terrible depression, and a labor strike swept the nation. Here's Rick Smith with more.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1916. That was the day a bomb rocked the Preparedness Day parade in San Francisco, killing 10 and injuring at least 40. The Chamber of Commerce and the newly formed Law and Order Committee organized the parade to shore up support for war production and eventual entry into World War I. But isolationist sentiment in San Francisco remained strong. Anti-war activists prepared pamphlets and protests for the march. Many trade unionists were opposed to entry into the war. Some considered the parade a response to the combative longshoremen strike raging on the docks for weeks. San Francisco had been a strong union town for years, known for strikes and labor disputes. 1916 was an election year, and already the city had been rocked by a number of strikes. Business interests launched an open shop campaign and began targeting labor radicals. They found their scapegoats in labor leaders Tom Mooney and Warren Billings, who were framed and convicted for the bombings. Journalist Carl Nolte points out that Mooney and his assistant had been trying to organize workers at the city's largest streetcar company, United Railroads. He notes their convictions were based on perjured testimony and doctored evidence. Incredibly, one of the prosecution's star witnesses wasn't even in town that day. But the convictions served to vilify labor militants as terrorists. Fremont Older, editor of two local newspapers, discovered the frame-up evidence. He and many others, including Upton Sinclair and Clarence Darrow, campaigned for years to free the two men. They were finally released after 22 years in 1939. The actual bombers were never found, though some have speculated that anarchists of the Galleanist movement were likely responsible. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
A Michigan judge has refused an early release for a teenager who the judge says was placed in juvenile detention because she is a risk to her mother. The young girl was initially on probation for biting her mother's finger during an argument. Circuit Court Judge Mary Ellen Brennan has said that her decision is in the best interest of the 15-year-old, referred to as Grace, who has been at a detention center since May for violating probation. The violation cited includes falling asleep when she was supposed to be doing homework during a global pandemic. According to Grace's lawyer, Khalil Biernat, there was no point at which she or her mother were, quote, saying, yeah, take my kid away from me and throw her in detention. In the courtroom, Grace herself said to the judge, quote, I believe this challenge has specifically brought my mother and I finally back together. I miss my mom. I can control myself. I can be obedient. Judge Brennan responded that Grace is exactly where she is supposed to be, and, quote, there's more work to be done. The federal government has made a deal to purchase 100 million doses of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine for $1.95 billion, pending FDA approval. The vaccine would be free to Americans, although there could be a charge to have it administered. Clinical trials of the vaccine, which Pfizer is working on with the German company BioNTech, began in April, with positive early results announced this week. Larger studies of the vaccine's safety and efficacy could begin later this month. The Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Defense announced the deal today as part of Operation Warp Speed, the administration's push to have a coronavirus vaccine widely available by January. Other companies that have already received large contracts as part of Operation Warp Speed include AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and Novavax. Amid fears of voter suppression across the country, protesters in Maryland are pushing Governor Larry Hogan to switch to mail-in ballots for the November elections. Diane Bernard has more on the story.
With mail-in voting for the presidential election becoming a partisan issue across the nation, a coalition of lawmakers and activist groups in Maryland is protesting in Annapolis today to demand Governor Larry Hogan drop his plan for in-person voting in November. The protesters say Hogan's decision amounts to voter suppression, since many residents would be unable to leave their homes to vote in the middle of a deadly pandemic. Mike Tidwell is with Chesapeake Climate Action Network, one of the sponsors of the demonstration. He thinks Hogan's decision was to curry favor with President Donald Trump.
It seems like Governor Hogan is bowing to Donald Trump, who's telling all the Republican governors, suppress the vote, don't let people vote by mail, and in the process, we're exposing people to a pandemic. It's immoral. It's wrong.
This week, Hogan defended his decision to hold a traditional election in November, citing chaos that occurred during the June 2nd primary, which used mail-in ballots. More people opted to vote in person in the primary, causing long lines and hours-long waits. Tidwell claims the long lines were because fewer polling stations were open during the primary. He says the primary had record turnout and was considered a success. He advocates using mail-in ballots in the fall, too, because otherwise the most vulnerable voters would be put at risk.
It's the communities of color who are most vulnerable to this effort by Larry Hogan to make people vote in person or to go through a confusing absentee ballot process that it's unnecessary and bureaucratic.
Tidwell says the protest also is honoring Georgia Congressman John Lewis, who died last week from pancreatic cancer. He says Lewis devoted his career to making sure everybody had access to voting.
It is ironic and tragic that we now have this contrast of a civil rights leader who's just passed away so that we can all vote at the same time that Larry Hogan is making it harder to vote.
For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Yasmin Kopanoglu, Dan Raphael, and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonio Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kopanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 8, it's KABU Talk Radio. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers, and tomorrow, host Ken Jones sits down with Judith Arcana, author of the new collection of short stories called Hello, This is Jane. Then at 11:30, tune in for Words and Pictures, featuring an interview with Linda Barry. All of these KABU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kabu.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On tonight's News in Depth, KABU's Nat Moon spoke with Damon Mott's story of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about the dangers of tear gas exposure.
We are lucky to sit down today, virtually, of course, with Damon Mott's story. Damon is the Health Climate Program Director at Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, an organization of health professionals and advocates that work with the community to educate and advocate for societal and policy change, all with the goal of protecting human health across the board. In the time of demonstrating against police brutality in our city of Portland, their work continues to be extremely relevant. Damon,
thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Damon, tell us about Physicians for Social Responsibility and a little about your role there.
Sure. So we came out of the movement to stop nuclear weapons during the Cold War. So a group of doctors and scientists worked together to conclusively show that there was this presence of radioactive particles in children's teeth near where nuclear weapons testing was occurring. And Physicians for Social Responsibility actually shared in the Nobel Peace Prize for that work in 1985 because it was such a helpful contribution in understanding that nuclear weapons have this horrible impact on people's health and livelihoods, even if they're not actually used in warfare. Of course, if they're used, it's absolutely devastating, and we have the position that we must never use these immoral weapons ever again. And that is sort of the roots of our organization. We've also seen that, you know, the philosophy of preventing what we cannot cure applies to nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war, and realized in the 90s and 2000s that those same issues are present with climate change as well. We have to prevent what we cannot cure in terms of the really catastrophic climate change scenarios, And I think that the same can also be said about militarism in both the way that the U.S. has been working in foreign countries, as well as domestically with an increasingly militarized set of police forces in different cities, and now with the federal occupation of Portland being a prime example of something where we have to stop this violence in order to preserve public health and safety of the people that are protesting using their First Amendment rights.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little about less lethal, or what some people are even calling non-lethal, munitions and how they're not actually what they claim to be.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking about this. You know, we started to witness what was happening as the protests for Black Lives Matter started to emerge in Portland, and were extremely disturbed by the ways that the Portland Police Bureau is responding to nonviolent protesters using tear gas and so-called, you know, impact munitions, and labeling all of these different weapons as non-lethal or less lethal, in order to make it sound like the encountering these and being exposed to these is no big deal, right? That it's meant to really downplay the impact that these substances have on people. And we really, you know, made sure to reprioritize and spend some concerted time and effort on addressing this issue, because we saw how urgent it was to call that narrative out and redefine it and make sure people know the severe health impacts of these weapons. Especially as we are in the midst of a rising respiratory pandemic, and case infection rates in Oregon for COVID-19 continue to increase. So it's already extremely unethical to use tear gas on a massive crowd of protesters where, you know, maybe only a few people are throwing water bottles or empty cans at riot cops in full body armor. To then decide that whole crowd needs to be exposed to this dangerous tear gas compound that can cause all kinds of viral illnesses, pneumonia, bronchitis, that following exposure, and also, you know, some people are reporting weird menstrual symptoms after being exposed to this material. People live in the neighborhoods that are nearby these protests happening, and a lot of people have been complaining about gas making its way into their homes and impacting themselves and their children as bystanders. And so we're seeing just a huge amount of impacts from just the tear gas alone. But then we've also seen, you know, that protester who was carrying a boombox who was shot by a rubber bullet to the skull by federal officers. In what is very clearly an example of how that can kill somebody. And he was very lucky to survive and is recovering well, but that was, I think, a good proof that these weapons can kill you. And the tear gas in particular massively increases the chances that coronavirus will spread among protesters and compromises people's respiratory systems at a time when we need them to be as strong as possible.
And what about chronic tear gas exposure, like night after night?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we've been advocating for stronger preventions against the use of tear gas at the state level and locally, and supporting the efforts of activists and protesters that have been pushing for a stop on the use of this material, because we don't really necessarily know exactly how people are going to be experiencing symptoms of continuing to be exposed to this time and time again. And I've seen that a lot of people are taking the efforts to make sure that they have like gas masks and things like that to limit their exposure. I think that's incredibly smart that they're doing that, because to be out there, you know, for example, as a journalist covering these protests night after night, it's one really should be concerned about the chronic and repeated exposure to this substance, because we know that in most cases, the more you are exposed to an air contaminant or a lung irritant, the more that compounds the risk of developing more serious respiratory illnesses and other kinds of symptoms. So we need to see an end to it as a harm reduction for the people exercising First Amendment rights to nonviolently assemble. And there's a really great blog post by Erica Moseson that says, non-lethal tear gas, not likely. And that's the headline of it. And we've been sharing that around. That's a really great piece of work by a pulmonologist in our area who basically just wrote a long post about how dangerous and how scary this is to see this being used so much on protesters, including children, and what that impact could be on people's bodies, both short term and long term.
Yeah, it's really interesting in that piece that you mentioned by Dr. Moseson. She talks about how physicians are required to use de-escalation tactics, which isn't really their job, but is essentially like a 100% a police officer's job.
Right, yeah. And I think there's really a lesson to be learned from the way that health professionals deal with people in crisis that other people need to start taking really seriously. And I really hope that, you know, that lesson can be internalized by everybody who's looking at the way our policing system is failing to meet community needs, especially in the needs of Black and Indigenous and people of color's needs. You know, doctors and nurses and other health professionals have long understood that you need to work with your patients and to really help set them at ease. And when somebody's experiencing crisis, you know, doctors and nurses know that it's time to use de-escalation tactics to help people calm down. And we know what works in de-escalating and helping people to you know, get back to a more stable and more reasoned frame of mind. And we're seeing just the polar opposite of that happen when police show up already decked out in, you know, head to toe riot gear and body armor. That does the opposite of de-escalation. It makes people's adrenaline spike. It makes people expect a conflict. It makes them feel like they've been made into the enemy. That makes them feel like they've been made to be expected to be dangerous. And that sets up this polarization and this dichotomy of us versus them by very nature of the way that police are showing up to demonstrations. And that's not just the federal law enforcement officials, that's the Portland police as well. One thing I really hope that folks who are watching Portland from other parts of the country and other parts of the world, I really hope that they understand that both federal officers and local officers have been tear gassing people and using these dangerous riot control munitions, and that both of them are culpable for escalating these protests that have been largely very peaceful and very nonviolent. So it's my hope that we can look to some of the models of healthcare clinicians to help inform us in figuring out what kind of a community safety model we want to see, and then that will help to guide us as we continue to work to defund the police and invest in solutions that actually work, and invest in anti-racist solutions and policies that can be doing so, that are built by the ground up by Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And that's, you know, that's where I would actually also critique health professionals as well, right? We need to also understand that a lot of Black and Indigenous and people of color have deep trust issues with our medical system because of, you know, very real racism that exists in our medical systems and in our healthcare clinicians. A very recent survey said that 40% of new medical students in 2016 believed that Black people had fewer nerve endings and didn't experience pain as much as white people, which is just junk science and racist. So, you know, we got lots of work to do in lots of different arenas, but you know, thinking about de-escalation and community safety is what I hope that we all are looking at in each of our different sectors.
Sort of on that same note, can you talk a little bit about how tear gas and these other tactics disproportionately harm communities of color?
For sure. So, you know, one thing I will say is that let's not forget why people are out on the streets, right? We've just been seeing the continued killing and lynching of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, of Tony McDade, of so many trans women of color across the country. There's just such an epidemic of racialized violence. And these protests are about pushing back on that violence. And I think, you know, I've noticed that the Black Lives Matter hashtag has not been appearing as often in a lot of social media circles about the protests. And what we need to remember is that this is a racial justice cause. And that means that there are going to be a lot of Black and brown people who are out at protests and marching for justice and demanding for justice. And that means that when those folks are out on the ground, they're going to be coming into exposure with whatever the police is lobbing at the crowd writ large. And we know from data and so many studies that police assume that Black and brown people are going to be dangerous in a very, you know, severe form of implicit bias. And what that means is that we've seen time and time again that police use excessive force as well as crowd control munitions much quicker and much more readily when the crowd has more Black and brown people in it than say a predominantly white crowd. But then we also see too that a lot of white people are coming into exposure with these chemicals and having these gases deployed on them and being fired at by these munitions simply because they're out on the in these protests and are seen as a threat because of it. So I would say that it's all connected to the ways that racialized bias has caused police officers and really everyone in our society to believe the racist myth that Black and brown people are dangerous, and that's just not true.
Damon, before we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts for our listeners?
Thanks. Yeah, I would just say, like, we need to be really, this is a time where we need to be really active in watching what is happening to our civil liberties. You know, the federal law enforcement that has been grabbing people and putting them into unmarked vans, that should be concerning everyone across the entire country. But we need to make sure that the local police are receiving the same scrutiny. There's now been protests for over 50 consecutive days in Portland. And for much of that time, it was just the Portland Police Bureau gassing and using riot control impact munitions on peaceful, largely peaceful protesters. And that needs to be worrying everybody. And we have to make sure that that's, the focus is on both our local police and our federal law enforcement. And we must demand justice to make sure that both are not allowed to use tear gas, which is banned in the use of warfare by the Geneva Convention.
Damon, we really appreciate the important work you do. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Damon Mott's story of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Find out more about the incredibly important work they're doing at oregonpsr.org.
This is KBOO